This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.
You're listening to Femi on FUBAR Radio.
The eyes to the right, 258. The nose to the left, 303.
Yeah! The government cannot keep on ignoring Parliament or ploughing on towards the 29th of March without a coherent plan. Yeah! She cannot keep on just running down the clock and hoping that something will turn up that will save her day and save her face. So it is surprising that the Prime Minister is not even here to hear the result of this vote.
Did you ever see executions?
No, but I saw a beheaded head in the bin.
In the bins?
Yeah.
What was that like when you first saw that? These are the heads of captives?
Yeah. Didn't pay me at all.
On the one hand, you said you didn't regret coming to be part of the caliphate.
No, I don't regret it.
I've just had an opportunity to speak with President Trump. And he, I would say to all my colleagues, has indicated he's prepared to sign the bill. He will also be issuing a national emergency declaration at the same time.
There is word the president will declare a national emergency. I hope he won't. That would be a very wrong thing to do.
It's important to note that when the president declares this emergency, first of all, it's not an emergency. What's happening at the border? It's a humanitarian challenge to us. We will review our options. We'll be prepared to respond appropriately to it.
Hi, this is Femi. This is The Floor Is Yours. Welcome back. I'm here joined by Lucy Pasha, who's a journalist from The HuffPo. Hi, Lucy.
Hey.
So, this week has been another just general shit show from left to start to finish. We've had another Brexit vote in Parliament where the government lost, but nothing really changed. We had the possible return of somebody from who joined ISIS. Kind of weird that we're having conversations whether or not we should let somebody who is a British citizen and has no other citizenship enter the UK. Mm-hmm. If they've committed a crime, surely that we just put them in prison, but we need to figure out whether or not they have done that first. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a case with a lot more nuance than some of kind of the right-wing commentators would have you believe. It's highly complicated, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think one of the main there's lots of points to consider. You know, that she was 15 when she left. She was a child. She'd obviously been groomed and radicalized, but now she's 19. She showed no remorse.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she's a British citizen.
Yeah.
And so when any British citizen commits a crime, whether it's here or abroad, you'd expect the UK to take responsibility for that. So. Yeah. I think it's very nuanced, very complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you said, there are thousands of extremely horrible people sitting in our jails in this country. We don't automatically say there's some other country's problem.
Well, exactly. And if you can't say, you know, that she's no longer British now because she's, you know, potentially a horrible person.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, British.
If that was the rule, I mean, we'd have got rid of, what's his name? Trump's pet. The guy from JGMB, Piers Morgan. We'd have got rid of Piers Morgan a long time ago if that was the rule for not
and
being
others,
British.
And others.
And many others.
Yeah. But I mean, I think another kind of key consideration to make is for her unborn child, obviously, who will be born to a British citizen. And obviously careful consideration has to be made for that child's welfare.
It's not a cut and dry story. I mean, if you bring back somebody who has joined ISIS, who has been part of a group that was putting heads into bins, then it's pretty clear that there's a security risk there. But at the same time, again, British citizen. Otherwise, we're just dumping our trash across the sea. And there's also a baby to consider, and that baby has committed exactly zero crimes. So the idea that somebody who is a British citizen by birth wouldn't have that right is also something we should question as to who we are as a country.
I think also you have to think. I mean, to me, it seems obvious. If this was a white man who'd been radicalized and who'd ended up on the other side of the world, who'd done something really atrocious, I don't know if we'd be having the same debate.
No.
I don't know if we would be saying, like, oh, can we really say this person is still British. Can we completely strip them of their nationality? I think that comes into it as well, which is uncomfortable.
And also there's the issue of Donald Trump, who has also had some interesting views as to how to keep out people he considers to be unfavorable. He's trying to declare a state of national emergency in order to get funding for his border wall, which is really, really interesting given that he is trying to basically steal funding from the entire U.S. government in order to gain funding for a wall that he said that Mexico would pay for.
Well, exactly. It's the irony of the situation, you know, that it's going to end up being U.S. taxpayers that are footing the bill and that are going to be worse off for this ludicrous, ludicrous measure. It's just preposterous, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, you could argue that he's making some sort of really bold, progressive statement by saying we're all Mexico in some way.
Well, it sets a very dangerous precedent, doesn't it? That basically, when things don't go your way, you can just declare a state of an emergency. What difference is there between that and just a dictatorship? I'd like to know.
Yeah, well, he's been trying to use executive orders to basically do whatever he wants. He tried it with the Muslim ban, he tried it with a bunch of other stuff, and now he's trying it with this.
Mm-hmm.
The case I can't forget. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, so we've launched a new series on HuffPost, which aims to hear from the people at the very front line of public service about just a really marking case in their career. So nurses, doctors, firefighters, police officers. We've done a lot of reporting around austerity and the impact of cuts to public services. The case I can't forget really wanted to give voice to those people. What does that actually look like in practice? What does that mean for the people that have got you know, much less staff, less funding, less resources, but still being asked to do the most kind of life-changing, heroic efforts in their day jobs. So we've already heard from firefighter Roy Wilshire, who lost two colleagues in the Harrow Court fire of 2005. Really, really harrowing story, really puts into perspective kind of the decisions that go on in those incredible moments that you can't even... I mean, you and I probably couldn't even imagine what it'd be like to be in a burning building and losing colleagues. This week we heard from nurse Molly Case about kind of the holistic care that she offered a patient above and beyond kind of medical treatments, that actually she realised she just needed to be an ear for him and how important that was in his recovery. So, yeah, stay tuned. I think it'll be a really interesting series, and I hope it'll really shine a light on the realities, the pressures that some of these professions are under, and fits in kind of well with the coverage that we're doing on austerity at the moment.
Well, I mean, it's the kind of the absolute tragedy of right now. One of the reasons why we are in this Brexit mess is because a lot of issues, largely around the NHS as a major example, and public services simply weren't being addressed. And as a result, we have a Brexit that is sucking all the political oxygen out of the air, and issues regarding actually looking after the people who look after us are simply being neglected. I mean, we're going to be speaking to Dr. Mike later, who is pushing to raise money for a charity that's looking to make sure that the mental health of doctors is also being taken care of, because we're having a crisis of that as well. So hearing from people that actually look after us is utterly important.
The pressures that these people are under, I mean, one case that it will come later in the series in the next month or so, is from a surgeon who, in his morning, amputated a child's leg, had to undertake this devastating, life-changing surgery to save this child's life. Within half an hour, was back in clinic treating his patients. There was no time for pause. There was no time to digest kind of what he'd been through or the impact that had had on him. No time even to sit down for a cup of tea and kind of talk about it with a colleague. It was straight into clinic. So it feels like they're being driven harder than ever before, and more is expected of them than ever before.
Well, yeah, I mean, we saw what happened back when the NHS was something that we thought deserved national airtime, when the campaigns and the protests were happening against what Jeremy Hunt was doing, and the absolute strain that was being put on junior doctors, which was just ridiculous, being made to work ridiculous hours, pay freeze, very little supports. It's just unacceptable.
And who were leaving the NHS in droves.
Yeah. We have a staffing crisis.
Yeah.
And another issue that came up this week is, it's the 56 Black Men campaign, which is basically this campaign to get, which has 56 pictures of black men, all wearing hoodies, and it shows the title of what the job is. So they might be lawyer, like doctor, that sort of thing. Basically undermining the stereotype about black men in hoodies being dangerous. And it's also being supported by David Lammy, and which is interesting given that recently I was mistaken for him one of the far right thugs outside Parliament, which is fun. He called me David Lammy. But it is kind of an interesting thing, and it's pretty timely given what happened with Liam Neeson a week and a half ago. That was an interesting conversation. What's your take on what happened with Liam Neeson?
Oh, it feels like months ago now.
Yeah, I know.
So much time's gone on. I think it was gobsmacking, to be honest.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it that he thought, A, that that was an acceptable thing to say, that it was relevant to bring up. And also, like, people missed the fact that he decided to bring up probably the most traumatic moment in his friend's life, just like wantonly, like during an interview, kind of paraded her personal life in front of everyone. Thought that was a bit of a dick move. The whole affair was just really shoddy, wasn't it? And I think it ties in quite a lot with this ongoing conversation around, like, well, you know, the way we used to think isn't the same as how we think now. And, like, you know, the lens that we view the past with, we shouldn't be putting today's lens on the past, you know?
Yeah.
Because you had the same case. Oh, you had another horrific case this week of Bob Frost, the ex-Tory councillor, who sent an image of blackface to David Lammy.
Wonderful.
And his justification for that was, you know, this was a screenshot from a BBC programme that used to play, and like I was just sharing, you know, something that's already, that, you know, we that was acceptable perhaps in times gone by or whatever.
What kind of excuses? with Liam Neeson, I mean, he said that his friend got raped when he was younger, and that he then went out looking for basically any black person to kill as a result. And on that, I understood the need for revenge. I got that he was furious with what happened to his friend. He wanted to lash out in some way. And in the first interview, he goes on about how it was wrong of him to seek violence, but doesn't address the racist element.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't address that his entire modus operandi when he was actually going out was saying that any potential black person who was aggressive towards him should be treated as if they'd actually committed a rape.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just the tarring everyone with the same brush, which is just not okay, because just put yourself in the shoes of an innocent black person who happened to get killed by the guy from Taken. It's
that there was no critical thinking in his argument there, which I thought was astounding. That he like, I mean, when we find ourselves in horrific situations, of course, weird things come into your head, don't they? Like, anger brings up all kinds of emotions, and maybe that was the first thing that came to his head. But why didn't the rational side of his brain take over and say, like, oh, actually, that's kind of a racist thing to think.
Yep.
Maybe I shouldn't, A, do that, and B, vocalise it, you know? Or question himself, like, why actually have I made that assumption? That why am I tarring all these people with the same brush? I think that lack of self-awareness and lack of ability to self-reflect in a constructive way was quite revealing.
Yeah, I understand the sort of point he was making in terms of, he didn't make the point. I understand the rationale behind it in that if you only ever see black people on TV in circumstances where they are the thug in the movie, the criminal, blah, 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 or in some sort of police show, then that's the only experience you've ever had of black people, and that's the only thing you're going to think that they are. And therefore, when you have a crime, you're going to think that they all somehow deserve it. And it's the same thing that we get with Muslims or people from the Middle East. The only time we see them on TV is on some news report about a terrorist attack. So it's not a surprise that we have all this Islamophobia in it. And so it is a response. There is a responsibility on the outlets that we watch that it then twists our perception of certain ethnic and religious groups. But he didn't properly address that, which is, again, unfortunate. And we have to move past this. But one point of progress, which I am quite happy about, is today we've seen the first ever UK-wide school strike and the strike for climate, which is very, very cool. We had Greta Thunberg speaking to the UN a few weeks ago, basically calling them out, saying, you guys keep talking all this stuff about climate change, but you never actually put your money where your mouth is. And more importantly, you're not bold enough to say that this isn't just about money. This is about the future of the planet. And you need to be bold enough to say that we actually need to deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, how uplifting to see this strike today. Mm. I'm so behind them. I think it's incredible. Thank God the children are our future.
Yeah.
because it's so important. And I agree with them. There's major urgency needed. This is the crisis that we're facing long before, Brexit knocks us all out. It's going to be climate change. I think that's really, really great. We had an incredible 15-year-old write for us this morning. She wrote a blog about why she was striking, and just how passionate this generation are about that and how high up on their agenda it is really inspiring. I've seen quite a lot of the strikers today saying that they really resent people making the assumption that it's just that they want to bunk off school when actually they do seem to genuinely care about this. So it's great. It's fantastic.
Yeah, very, 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 very cool. I mean, and the other thing is, as you mentioned, Brexit keeps sucking the air out of the room. Mm-hmm. And it's ironic because these issues, climate change, are the sort of things that don't see borders. Mm-hmm. And so it's the sort of thing that you can only really tackle as a community of nations, which is what the EU is. And so leaving that means that any efforts we make in order to address climate change are done locally and don't have as much of an impact. Not only is Brexit sucking the oxygen out of the room so we don't address these issues, but it's making us less able to address those issues in the future, which is just, again, really disappointing.
And just the sheer waste of resource, you know, that we're ploughing this time, energy, taking up, it's kind of crowding all of our public discourse when, you know, clearly we're not focusing on the real issues, the real issues that are killing us right now. I mean, air pollution is such a major thing in London. Like Sadiq Khan was talking about it earlier this week about how, you know, he's developed adult onset asthma. The number of people who die because of that kind of direct result has massively increased. So it just seems, I find it soul destroying.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, I mean, we talked last week with Matthew Todd about the utter absence of leadership in terms of addressing climate change head on. I mean, I went pretty firm in my dislike of living in London because of the. I have asthma and walk and riding my bike in this city. I feel like I lose a week of my life every time I pass behind a bus.
You probably do.
Yeah, it's. It's something that really needs to be addressed. So it is really great to see young people taking control of their futures. It means what we do, our future, our choice. We're saying that these problems aren't going anywhere. These problems are going to last longer than the next election. Mm-hmm. And so the priority is fixing those things rather than party politics.
And what is so interesting that you say about these problems are going to last past the next election, these are the people that are going to be voting in the next election. You know, they might be 15, 16 now, but in 3 years' time, they won't be. They'll be adults. You know, so And I really feel, I get the impression that, that this younger generation are looking for a different kind of politics. They're looking for people that are actually willing to champion their views, and climate change is important to them.
Exactly. Lucy Pasha Robinson, thank you very much. You're the deputy editor of the blogs editor of Huffington Post.
Thank you, Femi.
Thank you. And we're going to be listening to Dr. Mike on a Bike, who is the junior doctor who... I set off on a bicycle trip around the world, which is incredible. We spoke to him just before he set off last week. Here you go. Hi, it's Femi, and I'm here with Dr. Mike.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Pleasure. So you're a junior doctor, and you have concerns over the effect on doctors regarding mental health.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I am a junior doctor. I'm a kind of third year junior doctor out of university. I'm doing this big bike ride to raise awareness for the kind of increasing pressures being put on junior doctors at the moment, and ultimately the effect it's having on doctors around the country. There's increasing kind of levels of anxiety, depression, and tragically, in some cases, junior doctors are kind of taking their own lives because of their struggling to cope with the pressures. So yeah, so that's what I'm kind of trying to raise awareness for, really.
And you're going to be biking a fair way from the looks of things. I mean, I once I think my personal best is about 13 miles back and forth, so 26 miles I once did.
Nice.
But yeah. Apparently you're riding a little bit further than that. Where are you riding?
Yeah, just a little bit further. So I'm setting off from London and cycling around the world. I'm going to be doing 19,000 miles across 8 months, covering about 100 miles a day, the odd day off, just to give my bum a bit of a rest.
Okay, I feel like you might have just shown me up just a little bit, but keep going. Okay. Keep going.
Yeah, no, and then going through 22 countries. There's a little bit of flying over little bits of water and things like that, but. Yeah, I'm meeting the criteria for cycling around the world, and yeah, it's going to be amazing. I really can't wait.
So, I mean, 19,000 miles, 740,000 feet elevation.
That's it, yeah.
And over 259 days?
Yeah, so it's at eight months. It's going to be pretty hard going, 100 miles a day. And, you know, I'm no athlete. I've played a bit of sport at school, but by no means am I an athlete. So this is going to be new to me as well.
Wow. You're looking to raise how much?
So looking to raise 20,000 when we've already raised about 4.5 just before we kind of have even set off, which is amazing. Just from general, the members of the public being really kind and donating. And we sold nearly a hundred of my Dr. Mike on a Bike t-shirts with all the proceeds going to charity. So we've raised, you know, nearly 5,000 already. And I'm sure once I set off, we'll be able to get some support going and get closer to that 20,000.
How do people like get in touch? How do they monitor what you're doing? How do they donate?
So if you went on any social platform and put in Dr. Mike on a Bike, you'd find me. So you can follow it on Instagram, Facebook. My website is www.drmikeonabike.com. And then if you go to that website, you'll find big donate buttons to donate to my Virgin Giving page. And then I've got a tracking device with me that is linked up to a website so people can see live where I'll be.
Very cool.
Where I'll be camping out. So, yeah, so people can keep up to date 24/7.
Well, I'm very, very much humbled that an every guy like you would be, well, just proving just how resilient and dedicated and the fortitude that doctors have and going around the world. Well done and good luck.
Oh, well, that's very kind. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
And we're back. That was, yeah, as I mentioned, very, very impressive because that guy is cycling around the world to raise awareness for an issue that is really, really just utterly forgotten, which is the fact that the very people who look after us are not getting looked after themselves. But that is kind of the problem right now. We don't really talk about the NHS anymore because there's that big B word that keeps floating around. I remember a couple of years ago when the NHS was something that, you know, was important and people used to campaign about it, used to see doctors protesting in the street. But now we seem to have forgotten about the fact that our National Health Service is kind of an issue. But here I'm joined by Rhea Bernard and also Mike Galsworthy. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, I mean, the NHS wasn't doing great before 2016 anyway. it was limping from crisis to crisis. It was being underfunded, understaffed. The doctors themselves were being strained. What do you? Let's pretend Brexit wasn't a thing. What would the NHS need moving forward, Ria?
So I think that it's really important, if we're talking about the NHS, to broaden what we're talking about. Mm. I think that when we talk about the NHS currently, we're still talking about that 1948 NHS of doctors and nurses. Actually, it's massively broadened out to have a significant number of specialisms, including allied health professionals. There are 12 of us, and we don't actually get talked about very often in the debate around the NHS. Mm. What do I think we need to look at? Preventative healthcare and speech and language therapy, of whom I belong to, very much is part of that debate. And we need to be looking at things like early intervention, not just in medical care, but also in supporting children and young people with speech and language and communication needs.
Yeah, I mean, you're a PhD student in speech and language. You haven't worked for the NHS, but you have worked alongside it and its staff, and the threat of privatisation, I mean, you keep hearing about these terms like PFIs. What's that about?
So I think in terms of my profession, privatisation, definitely, there's a big threat there. And it's happening across a lot of allied health professions. Mm. So, yes, I was up until September last year, I was working in quite deprived areas in primary and secondary schools as a speech and language therapist in London. Mm. And I was employed as part of an independent practice. But that is partly because the NHS services in schools are under such strain, they're not able to provide the consistency all the time of support. Whereas that's where the issue is coming. Whereas actually we should be plowing resources and money into speech and language therapy services to support all our children across our mainstream and specialist schools.
Well, I mean, if you've got speaking language issues at that early age, that's going to set you off for life. Utter priority to put funding into that. So the absence of funding for that, or the absence of political will to fix that, is kind of shameful, really.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that there's a significant impact on the child and the young person in terms of their educational opportunities and their employment opportunities. But we also know that there's a wider impact on their family and community and society. You know, we know that 88% of young unemployed men have speech language communication need. Mm. We know that 60% of young offenders have a speech language communication need, and we know that 50 to 60% of people with mental health have a speech language communication need. My argument is, if you were to put the funding into early intervention for speech and language therapy, we could potentially offset a lot of those problems which have social and economic implications.
Again, shameful that we aren't already doing that. Mike is the founder of Scientists for EU and also NHS Against Brexit. But the NHS is obviously, as we just mentioned, a far broader issue than doctors and nurses. It's also just how we treat science as a country, how we treat expertise, the funding available. What would you say needs to change, Brexit aside for a second, in terms of how we handle the sciences in this country?
So we're moving on from NHS onto science.
Well,
I was sitting there prepping in my brain all this stuff about privatisation.
Let's go NHS first. Regarding the NHS, actually, fuck it, let's do Brexit. The NHS and Brexit, what's the link? I mean, many people voted for Brexit thinking that it would help the NHS. What is your response to them?
Right, you've switched it up again. No, it doesn't. And Brexit is already hurting the NHS for some key reasons.
Yeah.
One is finances, because just the fallen pound from the Brexit vote put 20% extra prices on everything. Mm. And so if we get about half our supplies from outside the UK for the NHS, that pushes up prices to the tune of about between 500 million and 900 million a year, it's been calculated, for supplies. And then on top of that, our NHS compensates Brits receiving medical care elsewhere in the EU. So that's a cool extra billion a year that it's cost the NHS just from the fallen pound. And then there's staffing. As we all know, EU nurses have been plugging gaps in our workforce for years and years, by about an extra 7,000 nurses per annum. But since the Brexit vote, that has been decreasing the number of nurses available by about 2,500 nurses per annum. And then doctors have started to follow as well. Mm. And when we've got 12,000 doctor vacancies, over 40,000 nursing vacancies, over 100,000 NHS vacancies overall, then the gap is increasing and the pipeline that we used to have to help us out to fill that is going. And then, and this then starts coming into science and stuff, around the NHS, like you were just hearing, there's tons of things going on with regard to community services, whether it be mental health services or social services, but then also research and getting the new technologies and the new drugs and the new medical devices and the new ways of doing things into our NHS to make it a more efficient system. And if we start breaking our frameworks of collaboration that we've built up internationally, then that is another thing that we are already seeing being pulled away from the NHS. Look at the European Medicines Agency, already folded up the flags and on their way out. And that is a massive loss, not just for the science itself, but also for all of that science framework which reaches into the NHS and keeps it up to date and advanced and on top of all the challenges that it's facing.
The European Medicines Agency was responsible for certifying new drugs for the market across Europe.
Yeah.
And so given if we're no longer part of that system, which is a risk in a no-deal Brexit, then it would mean that any big manufacturer that wanted to sell get a new drug certified, they're going to get this certified with the largest market first, and that would be the European market, putting the NHS at the back of the queue. Which means we're going to be, it can take longer to get new drugs available. Is that right?
Yeah, so biggest market in the world is the US market. And then in second place is the EU market, which even though it has more people in it, doesn't consume drugs at the same rate as the Yanks manage to get them down. So, okay. But if you break out the UK from the EU, then like you just said, it's about largest market first, where you can want to get things approved. And we just move right down the pecking order and our own pharmaceutical companies have said so, that we will come to your market at a much, much later stage. Switzerland and Canada usually take about an extra 6 months to get new drugs approved, and that is critical for when you're testing new innovative drugs that are associated or you need for rare diseases or that you need for certain cancers. You know, if you're in hospital waiting on that, waiting for the new drugs to come through, it's not good if your country has decided to pull you out to a lower place in the ranking system.
I've got a close friend with a very rare disease, and the need for new drugs to combat that is definitely an issue that is very personal to me. So the idea that we'd be put to the back of the queue in terms of getting access to those new drugs is something that I don't think anybody voted for.
And all of this is damage that would happen if there was no threat of no deal and we just smoothly moved into Theresa May's deal. We would still be taking all these steps down. An extra threat that's now being layered on top of all of this is this no deal scenario, because we've already spent in the low tens of millions buying up all this extra warehousing and refrigerated warehousing so that we can do stockpiling in case of a no deal Brexit. And then once we've stockpiled, are we going to distribute these medicines well from the stockpiling? And then there are things that you can't stockpile, like some of the diabetes type 1 drugs, but then also medical radioisotopes, which have such a short life that you can't stockpile them, so you have to spend more money on flying them in. So we are risking a whole load of patients here, as well as throwing away a ton of money. We can swear on this, can't we? Yeah.
Yeah.
A shit ton of money. Yeah. On basically a very expensive insurance policy so that we have the option to burn down our own house.
And how is Brexit affecting the areas of speech and language therapy?
I think that one of the biggest things and one of the saddest things about the entire kind of Brexit debate is obviously we have to deal with Brexit in the immediate future. Yeah. We're the time's running out. Of course, you need to be talking about that. But actually, there is so much wrong with our country in terms of inequality and divides.
Yep.
And they are not being addressed because we are focusing on Brexit. And in terms of kind of the world of speech and language or health, if we kind of broaden it out to healthcare, it's massive. I mean, you know, the schools I was working in, the issues that families were facing, you know, families who parents might be up at, have two or three jobs, trying to fit in going to the food bank, being able to support their speech and language needs was low down the pile, understandably, because they had so many challenges, housing, employment, I mean, you name them. And I think what is really upsetting is that none of those issues are... they're not being addressed, but they're not even being discussed. It's like that all the reasons that Brexit has come about in terms of a lot of the outcry of in my view of the public, at what happened with the referendum, it's like it's just been ignored.
Well, I mean, like I said, these issues used to be regular features on the news, whereas right now it's Brexit, Trump, third story of the day. That's pretty much all we get. And
it really saddens me that this is my country, Britain, in the 21st century, for God's sake. This is like neo-Victorian times. And a lot of these things, as you just said, you know, kicked Brexit off, and now Brexit's come along and blocked up the whole system, and so these things are getting worse.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, and also people are getting the exact opposite, because many people, decent people who voted for Brexit, expected that it would make the NHS better, expected that there would be more public money available for the NHS. And one of the things that people, many people don't know, is that one of the campaign chairs for Vote Leave that was behind that bus is a guy called Daniel Hannan. And he is now part of a group that is calling specifically for American firms to be able to buy up parts of the NHS. So he's one of the people that promised more public money and is now pushing for privatization by American companies, which is just utterly just disgusting.
He'd already been on American TV some years back saying, "I wouldn't wish the NHS upon anyone," when he was trying to advise the American population not to go with Obamacare plans and not to have the public option. And in fact, David Cameron tried immediately to disown him after that. But he has a long track record, as do many from the Brexit camp, whether it be Matthew Elliott and the Taxpayers Alliance, whether it be Nigel Farage himself and some of previous UKIP policy. Right across that broad set, there are tons of those voices, Douglas Carswell, that were all previously advocating selling off the NHS in one form or another, bringing in more privatisation, opening it up to the free market. That is what they want to do, and Brexit is part of that plan.
And we actually asked on a Twitter poll, and so you can get involved in this conversation because the floor is yours. Tweet at Fubar Radio, call in at 0330-223-0200, and we asked people what were the biggest issues facing the NHS, and you said, the smallest number of you said lack of beds, then the next number up, and that was 3%, then 29% of you said understaffed, 31% said it was privatisation, and the winner was the Brexit deal.
I actually did that poll, and I put privatisation.
Nah.
Well, I mean, because for me, that's been the ongoing underlying problem with the NHS that is breaking it, and actually Brexit is an exacerbating factor for that. In fact, issues 1, 2, and 4 are all interlinked. The staffing, the Brexit, and the privatisation are all bound into each other. Beds is kind of like a separate problem where we've just kind of lost the plot a bit on that, you know, just cutting the number of beds when we actually need more because it's a bottleneck, you know, it's nuts.
I mean, privatization does seem to be the way things have been going for a fair while. And it wasn't just under the Conservatives, because, I mean, it was the introduction of private finance initiatives, the PFIs.
And the internal market under New Labour. Both of those were experimented with under New Labour. And then basically when New Labour out and the Conservatives were back in, they were like, thank you very much for having opened these doors for us. And they have been pushing it further ever since. And a big change came in 2012 when you had the bill, the Health and Social Care Reformation Bill. I can't remember its name exactly. But that essentially introduce various mechanisms to help break up the NHS more into sell-offable bits and pieces. And this is something that David Cameron, when he came in 2010, had promised would not happen to the NHS. He promised there would be no top-down reform of the NHS, but then just 2 years later, it was Andrew Lansley who had already cooked up this plan. Here's another one who wants privatisation, cooked up this plan to start backing away responsibility of the Secretary of State for Health and start opening up the NHS more to commissioning that includes package deals available for private companies to start getting more and more involved. And that's the slippery slope that we're on, and that's what the Americans want to get a piece of. They tried to get a piece of that through TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership with the EU. The European community shut that right down. You know, this was where citizen power worked through the European Parliament forced a lot of transparency. We were the last country to actually fully insulate our NHS, and that died. TTIP as a whole died. But if we pop out of the EU and we're lonesome like that, and we've got a government that is chomping at the bit to get these companies in and work with these companies, then that's what's going to happen.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, a concrete example of that is that when they were negotiating between the EU and the US and that TTIP, they had a joint statement which said that nothing can happen in the negotiations which could limit our ability to nationalise or renationalise public services such as healthcare. Now, if you compare that with you've got Theresa May refusing to rule out selling off parts of the NHS to America. You've got Donald Trump saying explicitly, not even hiding it, saying that he plans to use post-Brexit UK-US trade negotiations to make the NHS pay more for drugs so that American companies pay less. And on top of that, you've got what Daniel Hannan's doing with actually pushing for that. So our NHS is significantly more exposed to privatisation as a result of the Brexit that was voted for, largely to protect it from privatisation. It is just not okay. We've got a tweet from...
All wolves in sheep's clothing.
Yeah.
So this was, just really quickly, I think it was in 2015 that Aaron Banks got work done to see what he would need to do in order to tip a population for Brexit. And he was told you need 4 million Labour voters on your side in order to do that. So there was a very deliberate plan from early on to pick up some issues that were really important to the left and get them on board that away. And so the NHS became a real target, even though for most Brexiteers, and Dominic Cummings, who ran the Vote Leave campaign, can tell you this, they didn't want to go near talking about the NHS. It was like, no, if you want to win this thing, we need to steal that Labour vote. And that's what they went for, completely disingenuously.
But that's what they've done. I mean, they know that the NHS is right at the core of our national identity. It's the thing that we care the most about. It's the thing that says we care enough about each other to contribute a little bit to make sure that everyone else is okay. And so that's why they chose to say that there'd be £350 million a week to the NHS. But right now they're even still going, where they're saying that there's be a Brexit dividend, which just doesn't exist. They're saying that they'll put another 20 billion into the budget. That's they're promising to do over the next 10 years, which is utter bullshit. Because not only is there going to be significant economic damage as a result of Brexit, which means that there'll be less money, but also people often look at the money that we send to the EU as this money that just goes away and we never get anything back. It allows us to be part of a system which makes trade cheaper, which means we save money well over what we give out. And then we just do the maths. Right now, the UK is part of the EU, and so there are 40 agencies across the EU which perform governmental functions, ranging from chemical regulation, the European Medicines Agency, which just left London, financial regulations, the European Fundamental Rights Agency, which I used to work at. Now, the cost for those agencies is split among 28 countries. If we leave the EU and we have to do those functions ourselves, the cost for that goes on the UK taxpayer alone. We are talking about paying more. And a concrete example is that when they, with the Galileo project, the GPS system that we were working on as the EU, again with the sciences, and the cost that was for that was about $8 billion to produce that system. And once and the plan is to leave that system because we're no longer part of the EU. In fact, we emphasize that only EU members could be able to actually use that system. And the cost for us to make our own system, which we plan to do, is $5 billion. So when you do the maths, $8 billion split among 28 countries or $5 billion on one country, guess who's paying more? So our NHS will deeply suffer. And you, Ria, you've noted that your area is getting less and less funding in terms of physiotherapy.
Yes, in terms of speech and language therapy, absolutely. So in terms of what's going on with funding and provision, a really big kind of battle, and it is noted in the new 10-year long-term plan, although I would like to argue and stress it's not really got a very significant, we've not got a very significant role in that plan, even though we should do, is that speech and language therapy is massively underfinanced. So what you're seeing is highly experienced therapy posts, which are then freezing and no one's replacing them. And so then you're getting new people come up who are developing as specialists, but then they're not, they've got no one to learn from equally, because we're always learning. That's what health professionals do.
Yeah.
And so we've got a huge demand, a significant demand in terms of children and adults, because I'm focusing on children because that's my experience. We've actually got a lot of speech and language therapists, but we don't have the jobs. And so what are you going to do? That supply and demand is crazy. Add on to the fact that if we think about social deprivation, so we've talked about around 10% of children have speech and language communication needs, right? Children and young people. In socially disadvantaged areas, that's 50%. So that is, the link is huge.
Yep.
I mean, I know myself, I was working in schools 2 days a week. I had caseloads of 45 children. I mean, can you imagine trying to cover that? And they range from language delays and sort of speech sound difficulties and stammers right through to kind of more complex needs associated with autism, ADHD, and various other needs, all being dealt with in a mainstream school.
And it's just a vicious circle, because you have people from deprived areas who have these issues that aren't being addressed because they're in deprived areas, and those issues then set them back for life, which then mean that those areas stay deprived and they can never get out of them because they're held back.
And it costs all society. It costs all society. It's a vicious circle for all of us, whereas we should have a virtuous circle. This is why I so object the term tax and spend, as if you're like, you've spent it on something and then it's gone. It's invest
yes.
and then pay back, and that's the virtuous circle that we need to get generated. I mean, because the problem that you highlight works right across health. Cancer, for example, will kill one in three of us. How much do we invest in it per head per annum? From charities, £5, from government taxation, £2.70. So if you think about how much you spend on a pack of peanuts, or Femi, you like popcorn, don't you? You like your bags of popcorn, or beers, or going out or anything. Compare that to how much that you are personally investing in a cure for cancer, which has got a one-third chance of killing you. It is nuts, the lack of underinvestment. And that's cancer. That's a big one in terms of all the childhood development problems that you're highlighting. If you don't sort that out early on, that screws up the rest of your life. That's a massive burden on your family. It is a burden on your community, on your school, on any employer that you work with, and on society as a whole.
Yeah, we've got a couple of tweets here from which said that, to anyone saying private, and this is from CP Kinase, to anyone saying privatisation, you've clearly never worked in the NHS if you think that that's the biggest issue. Try having no beds, no nurses, no docs, no longer an attractive career, underfunding, over demand, idiotic demands of an ageing population, and then you can get to privatisation. But I mean, no doctors, no beds, no nurses. I mean, these are problems that are linked to a lack of funding. So it's again, it's all tied together.
It's about system efficiency. If you want to deal with all of those, you need efficiency and you need investment.
I'm going to sound like a broken record by the end of this, but no allied health as well. It is so incredibly important. Yes, absolutely. Doctors and nurses, excellent job. I am not. In no way am I saying they don't. I'm saying that allied health work hand in hand. When somebody has a stroke, they go into hospital, they are treated by a doctor, they're treated by a nurse. They are also treated for their communication and swallowing needs if needed by a speech and language therapist. They're also treated by a physiotherapist if they need mobility support. They're also supported by a dietitian if they need support in terms of a change or modification to their diet. They're also supported in terms of social care when they're transitioned home. You know, it's very, very important that when we're talking about the lack of resources,
don't just talk about doctors,
we're talking about everyone. It's very, I just think, because the burden is huge. I mean, it really is huge. I completely agree. But also, we do tend to focus on hospitals. And what about, as you said earlier, community services? And that's where I would come in. I would be under kind of a community service into schools. And we were just talking about that. But preventative healthcare, and I'm kind of going on a tangent here, but just to give you some sort of solid ideas around what you could do if you were to invest in these services, if we can get to children before they're five, they have the most optimal opportunity of catching up with their peers.
Absolutely.
We know that children at five, their vocabulary levels will help to predict their ongoing literacy skills later. To me, it's just like a no-brainer. You know, put the money in.
We were talking about this before coming in, because we've both got sort of shared past in developmental psychology and the genetics of that, and how the genetics interact with the environment. if you can get kids early and make sure that they've got that healthy, stable environment early on, it makes an incredible difference. And not to invest in that is really to set up yourself for a whole social, emotional, and financial drain for the rest of their existence. Once kids get behind, then also the behavioural problems start kicking in as well.
I mean, what was mentioned in that tweet was also ageing population, which doesn't have anything to do with privatisation. But I mean, how do you how do you tackle an ageing population? Do you simply just go to a Durex factory with a hole puncher?
Bevy's mixing it up now. If you were to do that, you'd have to wait a good sort of 18, 20 years for people to start coming online in terms of resource. I personally would go for immigration myself as a stopgap, a better training up of staff that... of jobs that you need from your home base as well. You need both of those, actually. But the key challenge with the aging population is the technologies around it, the understanding of the individual, the ability to link hospital care with transport and home care, and it's a whole system of care. And this is where the NHS starts getting really messy, because it's not accident and emergency anymore. It's actually designing programs for people's lives that maximize taking care of them, and the costing is really difficult, because with the NHS it's all publicly funded, but when it comes down to actually end of life care, then you've got a whole mix of financial demands, some on the state, some on the individuals, and it is not clear where one ends and the other begins.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, I completely agree. And I think that something else that we could touch upon here in terms of the aging population is research. So research is absolutely fundamental in tackling the neurodegenerative diseases that we're seeing increasing, partly because we're living longer. Yep. So the dementias, multiple sclerosis, motor neuron disease, etc. And actually, something which is important in terms of the EU is funding. So funding for research... I am funded by the EU for my PhD. They partly fund me. So that's quite important. And I think that if we're going to try to tackle, and it's a very long-term sort of solution, but if we are going to tackle it, we do need to be pouring money into research, into some of those hot potatoes, dementia being a significant one, which does get a lot of attention. But there are other neurodegenerative disorders that could get a lot more attention, I think.
Yeah. And Mike's about to go off on Horizon.
What?
In relation to funding.
Oh, right.
EU funding.
Okay. Yeah. Horizon 2020. Yeah. 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 The EU science program. Yeah. So the point is that when we all put money together into the same pot, then suddenly you have this facilitation for 10, 15, 18 nation studies. Yeah. And all you have to do is pick a big pick and mix, put together your dream team, anyone you want to work with across Europe, across the associated countries that buy in, and then sometimes maybe further afield, put together that dream team and make one application, just one application for the grant. Like, if you wanted to put together a team of 10 nations and you didn't have that common pot, and you've all got a 20% chance of getting a grant, well, 20% times 20%, or like 0.2 times 0.2 times 0.2, okay, it ain't happening. And that's why it doesn't really happen elsewhere in the world. And on top of this, you actually see the results come good from having such large-scale programs. We know that when British institutions collaborate with international institutions, you get 40% more impact than you do when you just have British-only institutions putting out those papers. And then on top of that, by having that kind of framework, we attract people from all over the world that want to come to the UK to lead grand scale EU programs. So there's so much that you can do when you're looking for genes of small effect, when you're looking for particles of small size, when you're trying to see further into the universe. You need the bigger studies in order to get that more refined granularity. And this is what we're doing in Europe at the moment, par excellence. We have surpassed America in many ways just by sticking together as an ever-growing team.
Well, yeah, I mean, we are the biggest recipient of scientific funding from the EU, which is, again, money we get back. And also
toe-to-toe with Germany. Sometimes we're ahead, sometimes it's them. You know, it's been a friendly battle until recently.
Until recently.
Yeah, but not because it's become unfriendly, yeah. Just because we've slipped down the scale now.
But, I mean, Theresa May keeps saying that there'll be, I mean, with a 10-year plan, that there'll be more funding available. To what extent do you believe this? More funding available for sciences, more funding for the NHS.
Theresa May is totally reliable. Yeah, she never makes promises which she then rips up. Yeah, believe in her. Yeah, for sure. No, even if the UK puts in more money unilaterally, if you go through with Brexit, ripping us out from this big engine that we were running and driving, one, that added return on investment that you have from leading these big projects goes. The other programs that you have whereby you can attract talent from all over the world to the European research grant programs in the UK, that prestigious thing, you know, we lose. That means we're not attracting in the talent. General disruption means that if you've got innovative companies, large and small, leaving, then that means that you attract less talent in. And then also, if you get hostile with your neighboring countries, you don't look like a sweet place for, you know, a Polish researcher or an Italian researcher to come and bring up their kids in. And that is what is happening now.
Yeah.
So it's not just about we will put more money in and anyone coming here will be grateful for it. It is more complex than that. In science, it is about teamwork, international teamworks, and a national ethos that supports that.
Well, I mean, I mentioned before how I've got a close friend who has a rare disease, and there just simply wouldn't be the funding for it if it was just the UK, because if you've got a very, very rare disease, you're not going to get the funding for that in your country. Whereas if you get the sample size from across Europe, when you have enough people that make it worth developing a drug to address that problem, then you're going to get more investment and it's going to be a viable thing to create that drug and solve that problem.
So three levels to this. One is exactly the one that you've said, which is scaling up to do the research into it. The other one is the market for the drugs in order to treat these rare diseases. Through the European Medicines Agency, we had a dedicated fund which was for orphan drug development, so that you can approve them on a pan-European scale and actually make those drugs viable. Otherwise, these drugs wouldn't be developed. And then thirdly, when it comes to expertise for support networks for individual patients, oftentimes there are kids in the UK that the doctors don't know what's wrong with them. They don't know what's wrong with them, but we've got a pan-European network. So sometimes a kid with a rare disease, undiagnosed in Stoke or in Southend-on-Sea, actually has it diagnosed by someone in Turin or Copenhagen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's how we work together. And then there are the patient frameworks, the patient support groups, which are pan-European as well. This is what it means to work together.
Yeah.
Isn't it beautiful what we have built under the radar in science, in health, over 40 years, taking care of each other?
It's almost as if the spirit of international teamwork has kind of been hurt in the last couple of years. But, I mean, Theresa May is promising with this 10-year plan that she's going to be addressing the issues that were previously neglected, such as mental health, learning disabilities, autism. But, I mean, I guess that would be my final question to you. What would be, if we put Brexit out of the way, what is the first thing that you would say we needed to just do immediately in terms of mental health, in terms of the NHS and healthcare as a final thought?
I think that if we kind of put it into the context of this 10-year plan, something that I felt was glaring out at me was that Theresa May saying, you know, this plan is going to address all the issues and we're going to provide funding. But there's a great big gaping hole. They don't address in this plan early intervention in terms of children. So early years intervention. So I'm not talking about early intervention for things like cancer. And that's absolutely fundamental. I'm so pleased to see that in there. But it doesn't actually talk about early years a great deal. It talks about, which is very welcome, supporting expectant mothers in terms of maternity care. And that's very important. But it doesn't talk about how we're going to support early years. And so I suppose what I would say is that that is something that is a massive hole in it. And we need to be pushing money in. We've talked about it quite a lot in terms of prevention. The mental health angle, I'm glad to see there's more money in it. And I think that you know, I wanted to kind of share this because I think it's really important to understand. But so CAMHS, the Children and Adolescent Mental Health Services, are a fantastic service, but they are under incredible strain to the extent that I had a situation a couple of years ago where a child tried to jump out of a window, and we wanted an emergency referral. A child. When we made that referral, we were told it's an emergency. We'll see that child in 40 weeks. And I was like, 14, 1-4. They said, no, 40, 4-0. So yes, the 10-year plan is addressing that. That's really important. But actually, that child was a lot older. If we'd have potentially got there earlier, would that have happened?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's just unforgivable that we're not doing the thing. I mean, the first responsibility of government is to look after its people, and we're clearly failing in that.
Absolutely.
I guess final thoughts from you, Mike?
Yeah, I would agree. Prevention is key. Matt Hancock has been saying that recently. Mm. Just a couple of years after this government stripped out all of the responsibility for prevention, put it on local councils and cut their budget, they're now saying we need more investment in prevention. So, So prevention, definitely. Yeah. Joined up services, definitely. Investing in all of the technology that makes that more efficient. Mm. And I would also be stripping out privatisation for the very fundamental reason that it is wasteful in order to have multiple tenders all over the place, with profiteering as a motive for many entities. Mm. That is something that needs to be redressed. So those three.
But guys, thank you very much. I think the takeaway is it's better if we save lives. I think that's a good lesson to learn.
Helping each other is not just a nice thing to do, it's kind of important.
Good to know. This has been The Floor Is Yours. It will be available on Spotify as well. We will see you next week. Thank you very much to Rhea Bernard and Mike Galsworthy. See you next
Cheers.
Week.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.